This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Back in the studio with Dan Workman.
Hi, Robert.
How's it going? Thanks for coming in. That was a piece by your band.
Yeah, that was a piece by the SK1 Project called Kawasaki Green. And the last time the SK1 Project was actually played here, we were playing live on the air in this room.
Oh, man. That's right. You said you have like a long history with KPFT.
I do. I originally played live here on the Funhouse show back in 1980. So... a long time ago. Longer than I'd like to admit.
And you also, so for our listeners, Dan is a music producer, has a band, and also I guess gets into like art performance.
I do performance art pieces. Also, probably one of my bigger claims to fame here in Houston is I'm one of the owners of Sugar Hill Recording Studios, mm-hmm. which it, of course is like a really old institution in the music business here in Houston.
So I think Dan has like... a wellspring of information that we can talk about. So let's see how much we can get into it. Like, so talk a little bit about just like your history with like the music, the Houston music scene, and like.
Well, my history in the music scene goes like back embarrassingly far. I always played in bands. I started playing in bands when I was in junior high school. When I was college aged, I was lucky enough to form a band called Culture Side here in town that got a lot of critical acclaim and was sort of a arty experimental rock band that, you know, sort of navigated the waters of the punk rock scene. We really weren't punk rock, mm-hmm. but those were the people with a broad enough, you know, attitude to accept what we were doing. I did that band with Perry Webb for almost 20 years.
Oh, really?
Released a lot of stuff. Actually, we're re-releasing material now thanks to the internet. You know, we can find the five people that still care about us and, you know, they want to hear what we're doing. So Culture Side was a great springboard for me. I got a chance to meet a lot of people in the Houston music scene as well as nationally, and have always been a resident of Houston, have always come back here, played in a lot of bands in Houston, and then I started engineering, audio engineering for a living around 1986.
Houston, to me, it always seems like it's fairly easy to like create stuff and do stuff, but we don't, like Houston doesn't really have a, well maybe it does now, but it doesn't seem like it has like a an identity as like, you know, we do punk rock or whatever kind of music.
Well, musically, that's definitely true. In the performing arts, we have a few things that we are noted for. We're noted, first of all, for the visual arts here.
Yeah, yeah.
And our dramatic, you know, arts, the Alley Theater and, mm-hmm. and the theater scene is very, very vibrant here. In the musical arts, there's a very... I guess a lack of infrastructure. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're a huge city, you know, mm-hmm. fourth mm-hmm. largest city. If you include all of Harris County, we're gigantic. We're like L.A. And there's a lot of ambiguity in the music scene. I have a lot of ideas as to why that is. I think it's because Houston's decentralized. Mm-hmm. It's an unzoned city, and for its size, that's unbelievable. It's the only one like it, probably, in the United States. So we have lots of little downtowns. We have lots of little entertainment areas, mm-hmm. and because that was never consolidated, music as a performance is pretty fractured across the city. There's no one place to go get it all.
Yeah.
So we grow up sort of unsophisticated. We know what our little thing is, mm-hmm. and that's about it.
I notice whenever I'm looking in like the music section of the Houston Press, you know, trying to see what concerts are coming, there are all these bands and groups that I have like no clue as to like who they are, what kind of music they play, because
that's
I think
true.
It's that thing about, like you said, being unsophisticated and not exposed to like,
and we have amazingly talented people, and a lot of them leave Houston, and then some of them stay here and develop these incredible followings, but there's not sort of a connectivity to like the rest of the music world through that. Now, with the advent of the internet and being able to promote yourself, and we could talk the rest of the show about that, it's opened up a lot of avenues, and for new kinds of artists,
mm-hmm,
too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for people that make really great records but don't ever play live, and they actually have their fans. You know, you can go listen to them on the internet. And then there's people that really can't make a very good record, but they have this incredible live show, and they can get their information out on the internet and put up YouTube videos, mm-hmm. of them rocking the house. So everything's changing in the business as regards how one promotes oneself. And in Houston, because we don't have this way that's been done for a long time, we don't have the infrastructure and the way of doing business, it's wide open. So it's an extremely interesting period right now.
Do you think that infrastructure could be created, or are we just too far past the point where...
I think that if it was to be created in the old school way, that it would be a step backward. I think that we're poised to be what's next,
yeah, okay.
immediately, like right now.
Okay.
I'm counting on it. I'm not leaving.
I hope not. You know, I was checking out your website. You've done a lot of stuff, so I think we need people like you to stay in Houston.
Well,
so.
Thank you.
All right. So, as a producer and engineer, like what kind of stuff do you? Well, I guess you do all kinds of stuff then. From checking out the.
Well, I do, and one of the reasons is that there, you know, I did a ton of punk rock bands at one time. I did mm-hmm. a ton of Spanish rock bands at one time. Right now, I'm in this long singer songwriter phase, particularly female singer songwriters, mm-hmm. and I really consider myself a music guy. I'm not a style guy. People don't come to me.
What does that mean, a music guy?
Well, I love songs, okay? So whether I'm doing a gospel record or I'm doing an avant-garde electronic record or I do a singer-songwriter record,
uh-huh.
I can get into the song. I like songs. Not a certain style of song. I like good short stories, and that's what good songs are. And as a result, I can adapt myself. I have a pretty good grasp of a lot of musical mm-hmm. literature, and as a result, I can kind of learn whatever type of music I'm drawn to. And I have another key, and that's usually I work with pretty talented people, so you know it sounds good from that aspect.
I was very curious about that, looking at like the list of musicians you'd worked with, and you know, some of it, you know, it was like I saw, you know, Destiny's Child on there, I saw Lil Wayne, but then there were like all these, like, there was gospel, there was all the different forms. So how do you? I mean, just different forms of music. Like, how do you, how do you switch that mindset? How do you learn that form and, like, work in that? And then, I don't know how studios work. The next day, maybe you're working on something completely different.
Well, I'm kind of proud of that. There's a word that's you don't really hear very often. It's called polymath. And a polymath is somebody that has a lot of knowledge in many diverse disciplines. And for whatever reason, my musical education was extremely diverse. And so I'm real comfortable and I'm conversant with a lot of language, say, in opera.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know a lot about, you know, a lot of different operas, but I know the mechanics of singing an opera and what the singer has to go through. The areas that I'm not very familiar with, it's really funny, is country music. I'm not real good in country, yet I've cut some good country bands. I'm talking with a gentleman named Kevin Patterson right now from Houston, has a really successful sort of Texas country band called Trucker's Choice.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted me to, you know, we're negotiating about me producing his record. I'm like, let me just tell you up front, like, I don't know the literature. I have, you know, I'm not going to be the guy that comes in with the great standard ideas and knows intuitively what to do with country arrangements. And it didn't scare him away. So that actually works for me in some ways.
So possibly he's looking to maybe take an alternative route with that type of music.
Well, if I work with him, that's what he will get, regardless of his intentions. And I hope I do. He's a really good band.
So, okay, you work with these artists, I mean, as an engineer or as a... I mean, those are different roles, engineer or producer.
Engineer and producer are very different roles, and I'm proud to be both, and the first part of my career was spent learning to be a good engineer. You know, the engineer is, if we look at the movie metaphor, everybody's real familiar with watching documentaries on how to make movies.
Mm-hmm.
The engineer is the cameraman. Like, the director and the actors, they all do their thing, and they tell the cameraman what they want the shot to look like. And the cameraman and the DP, the director of photography, are the people that are responsible for getting that on film. Well, the engineer is that guy in the room. It's like the musicians and the producer tell them what they have in mind. The engineer is the guy that makes that sound occur, you know, helps create the sound in that context. And therefore has a big creative impact on the sound of the record.
How do they communicate with the engineer about that? I mean, when you're talking about sound, I mean, are they playing examples of, like, you know, we want it to sound like this?
Well, when you start out with a new artist, that's exactly what you do. You take known CD references that, you know, commercial releases or things that the artist can point to and go, I like the way the drums sound. I like the way the guitar sounds there. I like the way these vocals sound. And so you develop a sort of a syntax and grammar to talk about what you like. When I talk to a hip-hop artist, when he says that he wants the kick drum to sound fat, that's totally different from when a rock musician says he wants the kick drum to sound fat. Mm. But they're using the same word. So you have to kind of know what the grammar and syntax is. So we'll listen to CDs together. We'll spend a lot of time together. So I know what they're talking about. And then at that point, it becomes sort of like we enter into the stream of the love of the music together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the journey begins. And that's where it gets really interesting for me.
Okay, and as a producer, I guess that would be the director.
Yeah, the producer's the director of the movie. The guys with the money, they sit down and talk to him, and they say, "This is what we want." And he's responsible for working with hiring the right actors, with working with hiring the right photographer, in my case, the engineer. I will hire the studio musicians in many cases. I'll work with the artist to make sure that the song says what they really want it to say.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, you know, the lyrics might be a little clunky at some point.
Mm-hmm.
I like to write bridges. I'm really good with singer-songwriters that don't have any bridges because I'm, for whatever reason, is the guy that comes over the bridge of the song. So, yeah, and as a producer, my job ranges as the guy who gets it done. And I'm also the guy that sort of, like, cuts through any sort of communication problems with the artist. I'm the mountain guide. I've been up the hill a bunch of times.
Okay.
You know, so I know where all the danger points are, and I can get them up there. Get the job done.
Okay, so I listen to a lot of hip hop, so like most of my questions might come from that realm. But I mean, we can take them wherever. But in rap music, like the last maybe 8-9 years or so, like there was, you know, there was a trend of, you know, having 7-8 producers on an album, when before that it was like, you know, you'd have one producer. And how do you see that? Well, I already know how I see it affecting it, but I that seems to be a change, like coming back to that, at least from the kind of stuff that I'm listening to. Like, it's going back to producer created music, and like I think a lot of that is driven by, I think, the internet, because, you know, people put out these all vocal albums or whatever, and like some DJ gets it and like remixes it. I'm thinking of like Jay-Z's Danger Mouse album. And
totally.
Like, as a producer, like, how do you see that stuff going on? Does that happen in like other forms of music? Like,
it does indeed. It's really interesting. That is a very good question. One of the things that hip hop taught the rest of the music industry is that a really great way to promote the other artists on your label or artists that you see up and coming is, or producers, is to have all of these people guest appear on records.
Mm-hmm.
It seems so logical. And in the country music realm, back in the day, that was done quite a bit. But people have forgotten about that. So when you had these hip-hop records and rap records coming out featuring all these other artists, and that you were sort of anointing them, you know, like in introducing them. Now, the same thing started to happen with producers. When I started working with Destiny's Child, there was a different producer for each song, practically. The album credits ran so long that they were adding pages, you know, to the booklet. It had to, like, put it in the tiniest little letters. As a matter of fact, the first time I had to get out a magnifying glass and find where my name was. And believe me, I wanted to know where my name was on that record. And it became... The good part of that, which is getting a lot of people involved in a project, started to give way to a sort of a more commercialized version of that. Mm-hmm. Then it became a pecking order deal. It was less about all these people contributing made for this wonderful whole, than it was just sort of like this montage or collage of efforts. And in in the urban music scene, you would see that because songs started to sound very, very different from one to the other, even on the same record. And accepted, in some cases, that was cool. But for the most part, you missed the vision. Now, I'm an old rock and roll guy. So when you hear Dark Side of the Moon, every song interlocks to the next one perfectly. It was this wonderful vision of these very few people working in a room together. Beatles records, same thing. Led Zeppelin, many of the Led Zeppelin records. It's carefully crafted, very, very carefully put together and very controlled by a small creative group of people, where now we have these larger, much more diversified, you know, sets of influences.
Yeah, like, some of the albums are, like, they sound like a collage, like, a different things. And I always wonder, like, who is controlling... You know, you have one song with a certain kind of drums, and you have another song with different kind of drums, and, like, you know, they don't always match up.
Well, man, let's be honest. When was the last time you sat down and listened to a whole CD?
Exactly.
From the top to the bottom.
Exactly.
Now, we don't really have albums anymore. We have playlists. And so I get hired 90% of the time not to make a full record, but to do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 songs. I've been really fortunate in the last year. I got the chance to work with a singer-songwriter here in Houston, Ann Liu, and with a co-producer, Eric Jarvis, and our engineer and my dear friend, Steve Christensen. And we got to sit down and do a whole record. And, man, Ann is this amazing songwriter who was very inexperienced in coming into the studio, and I had this wonderful team of people that was very experienced and loved her music. So I got to craft each song, you know, I got to put it all together.
And when given the opportunity to do a whole album, how do you set it up? Because, you know, when you first put the CD in, a lot of times, you know, the first track... Well, again, I'm coming from, like, mainly I kind of critique hip-hop.
Let's talk hip-hop, man. But I can translate. That's fine. No problem at all.
You know, so, like, a lot of times what I would like is, like, when the first track is, like, just really hitting and just, like, boom, and it's really fast. And then it kind of does a movement that can go through the album, you know, highs and lows and that kind of thing. Is there, like, a standard way, I'm sure there's not, but, like, is there a standard way that an album should take you up and down and end in a certain way?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, the people that make records are very conflicted about this. Okay. Myself, once again, this is a very good question, because we're sequencing Ann's record now, and Ann came up with this amazing sequence, so it got us all off the hook, which is great. But you kind of want the experience. You're going to act as if people will listen all the way through and read it as chapters in a book.
Okay.
And, if they decide that they like the fifth song and that's the one that goes on their playlist, then so be it. But you have to act as if, because those of us that grew up back in the day of listening to 22 Minutes Aside, we're invested in how those songs, you know, run together. And there are, thanks to the internet, there are those other four people on the planet that are interested in that. So we can find those guys and we want to please them. Usually what I like to do is have the very first thing you hear say something very poignant, to the point, and strong about the artist. You don't want to challenge the listener to go through a 1 minute very emotional intro before you get to the meat and potatoes of the song.
Yeah.
It ain't gonna work, you know. I mean, like, unless you already have a long time relationship with that artist. You know, if Radiohead did that, or Wilco, which they have done, I haven't heard the new Wilco album, but the last one lost me because I couldn't get through the first song. It was just so freaking long. It just, you know, I couldn't hang with it. After that, you try to take the listener on whatever the emotional arc of the record is. Hit the high points, set yourself up for the really strong parts of songs and songs, so you actually go through a journey. And you know, once again, if you're, you know, out in the car and you're on some long trip and you accidentally listen to the whole CD, you know, it will have taken you somewhere and dropped you back off in a safe place.
That's another point I'm interested in. Like, how has how has it changed, well, the way that people listen to music, how has it changed? Because I am a visual artist, and so I have, like, these periods where I can listen to a whole album in the studio while I'm working, you know, 3, 4, 5 hours or whatever. But I don't imagine other people have this time where they're just sitting in one spot. Maybe if they're at a cubicle, but who can, like, really listen to an album like that?
Yeah, well, you know, back when I was growing up, once again, you know, this is the danger of being old. I'll refer to these previous times in ancient history. We all saved up our money to buy stereos. Mm-hmm. And man, like, you could, you know, who had what stereo was a big deal, and how they sounded and what we were doing in our mm-hmm. house to make it sound good. Nowadays, you want an iPod and you want to own more music than I ever could imagine owning, you know, like in the palm of your hand. Mm-hmm. And it's a feature-rich environment. Like, I can listen on my earbuds. I have this cool thing to slot it in the house. I've got this cool remote control. I've got this thing where I can listen to it underwater. There's not as much concern about, like, the music or how it sounds. And you know what? I'm almost okay with that. You know, I realize that music is taking a different role for people. Also, living in this feature-rich environment, we got the internet, we got satellite TV, we got the Game Boy, we got so many other things, I don't want to say distractions, but things that are vying for our attention, mm-hmm. that if I can get somebody to listen for like 4 minutes, I'm blown away. You know, I mean, I have this plan. I want to do this project where we do 1 minute songs.
Oh, okay.
And you know what? I'm not going to release 70 of them on a CD. How about like 10 1 minute songs? And I want $10 for it. I really do.
Oh, okay.
And you know, see if you can say something musically in the arc of 1 minute. Now, there used to be a punk rock band called the Minutemen, and they specialized in doing this. And they would go, and they, you know, that was sort of like their presentation. But they were hurry up. They were like, let me see how fast I can play this song. We'll play it in a minute. I want to see if I can create, you know, like BMW films, okay, that are available on the internet in some satellite markets that are available. There are 5-minute dramatic films that are amazing.
Okay.
In BMW, the automaker, or in my case, I like their motorcycles, they sponsor them. Incredible art form.
Okay.
You know, it's like short, same. I just read that, I don't know if it's Viacom. Anyway, it's one of the television distribution companies are creating 5-minute dramatic series for cell phones.
Oh, really?
So you will watch, you know, the version, you know, of Lost, but it's a 5-minute episode available on cell phones only. So anyway, we're competing for such smaller amounts of time. You know, I could sit here and tell you how I think it's, you know, the society is going to hell in a handbasket and a bunch of other old guy things. I think it's changing. And as an artist that loves music and, you know, somebody that's involved in playing it as well as mm-hmm. producing it, I want to find a way to get somebody's attention. And even if, you know, if my window of opportunity is a minute, bring it on. You know, I want to try that.
Two things. About the 1 minute thing, like, one of my favorite MCs is a guy named MF Doom. And
tell me about that.
Okay. Well, he's this guy, he does, and the one of the things that annoys me the most is that his songs are really short. They're like amazing songs, but they're like, you know, minute and a half. 2 minutes is like a really long song. And so you turn the song on, and again, it's because I'm always in a situation where I can listen for a long time. I'm getting into this song and it's over. I'm like, I gotta go hit repeat or play it 2 or 3 times just to get what I want out of it. And so it just,
like, he gets you going and then he leaves you.
Yeah,
he drops you. Okay, well, look, here's the deal. Here's where I need to work with him. Okay, he's making the mistake of not dropping you back off at the safe place. He's leaving you down the block stranded, wanting more of that groove. Now, admittedly, especially in hip-hop, so much of it is like groove-oriented. Like, once mm-hmm. you've got it going, you don't want it to stop. It's dance music.
Yeah.
It's things where you move. That said, I bet you it could be done. I bet you it could be done in a way where the arc of that groove could, like, drop you back off in the safe place.
Okay. I have to say, you know, his albums, he's one of the few artists where I won't say the whole album, but pretty much I can listen to about 90% of it at one sitting and, like, be really.
Man, that's saying something.
Man, I forgot my second question. Oh, okay. Again, since we're competing with all these different ways of listening to music, and I kind of think like some of the audio is a little downgraded, like the,
yeah,
you know, how does that affect the way you produce music? Like, you know, I like to really listen closely and hear all the different things that go in,
yeah,
how loud things are, how,
yeah,
you know,
man, let's talk about that.
But if you're listening, you know,
well, you know, look, once again, back in the ancient times when we were all buying cool stereos and smoking pot in our bedroom and listening to music and sitting in one place, that meant, you know, a different thing. We wanted to hear everything. It was all about buying the stereo that sounded the
mm-hmm,
best.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, it's like your earbuds have fallen out your ear. You know, it's you got like 5,000 songs on a, you know, this tiny chip, and you realize that the compression scheme is like, you know, the music may not be quite as clear,
mm-hmm,
but boy, you got 5,000 songs. So yes, as a producer, like a lot of the detail that we build into a song may not translate. And I'll tell you, when I'm thinking about how a song's going to sound and we're putting it together and we're working on it in the studio, I try to put as much detail in there so that it does please the person that's looking for that.
Okay.
But at the same time, it still reads like, you know, the billboard from like 1,000 yards
mm-hmm,
back,
mm-hmm,
like you still get the message. And it does. There are guys right now, I don't think I've ever done it, but I've heard of guys that have actually mastered records so that the MP3 sounds a little bit different. So it will be, it'll pop.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, it'll pop more.
I think the only contemporary place I can think of where people still are concerned about how something sounds and speakers or whatever is maybe when people trick out their cars.
Totally.
Yeah.
Wait, you know, wait a second. That's a great thing, too. Back in the day, we were all sitting there smoking pot, listening to our stereos, okay? And we weren't moving. I guess I can say that on the record. Listen, we're going to clean it up. Okay. Nowadays, you're right. Where you get your speakers and where you get people to really pay attention is in their home theater situation,
mm-hmm,
where you have to sit in front of that TV. There, 5.1 really means something. And there, in your car, your stereo setup really does mean something. And I'll tell you that almost all producers and engineers will also check all their stuff in their car. We all do it.
Like, really?
We mix. There we are sitting around $1 million worth of equipment, okay? We burn CDs when we go out to the car. And that's where we really know if we've done it or not.
And do you burn it as an MP3?
No.
Okay.
I'll listen to it as an AIFF or WAV file.
All right. We got about 10 minutes left, and I know we brought some stuff to play.
Yeah, so, you know, and I'm real conflicted about that, because what I want to do is, like, have everybody hear how incredibly diverse I am and all this other stuff. But you know what I think I would like to do? On the first disc, I guess Radio Disc 1, the second song is one of the songs that I did for Ann Lou, and it's the title song of the CD. It's called Perfect Rainy Day. This was a song that really came to us in a real raw and primitive form.
Okay.
Like Ann just like kind of playing it on her piano at home and all this crazy reverb on her voice. And like, I don't know. And by the time we finished the song, we had scored strings and horns and all kinds of
really?
Stuff. So it's this big surprise. And so I think I'd like to play that.
Okay.
And
yeah.
Ann, I hope you're listening, girl, because here it is.
Free, a golden boy who had him what's to lose, and in the end just who's to say what's really real. A golden boy who had it made, daily waves and blew it all away.
Back in the studio, and that was Ann Lou.
Ann Lou, man, that was cool to listen to over the air. Thank you for the opportunity.
No problem. I enjoy listening to it. What went into that song?
Well, Eric Jarvis and Ann and I made an acoustic guitar demo, and then we had Matt Johnson, who was Jeff Buckley's old drummer, come play drums for us. And after that, we added our own parts. I played a little bit of plastic toy keyboards on it, and we had some really wonderful keyboard players. Paul English played on it. We had Max Dyer play cello, and oh my goodness, I'm spacing on the name of the person that played the trumpet, and that's just horrible. Dennis Dodson. And we came up with the arrangement. You know, the little last part that sounds like a waltz was something that we came up with back in my office. It wasn't a part of the original song. It was really cool.
You said you guys had, you know, produced some strings and stuff into it.
Yeah, Eric wrote a string arrangement to this and played the string parts, and all that was done hip-hop style. We did with keyboards.
So, okay. So, like, one guy probably did it all?
One guy did the string parts, that's for sure. You know, the these days, like, there's certain things. I'd love to go to Abbey Road and do the London Philharmonic, you know, but that wasn't in the budget. So we, and the string parts sat back in the song somewhat. Mm-hmm. So if it wasn't a real person, it wasn't going to hurt the song.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So Eric came up with the string parts and did it just in the new way we do it. He did it at home in his own little stuff, and came back to the studio and delivered them.
I'm fascinated by that stuff, like, all the new ways you can create stuff. You said you played a bunch of toy keyboards?
Yeah, you know, my band, the SK1 Project, will do a lot of that. We use Circuit Mint Casio keyboards, which I just absolutely adore using. There's this Casio keyboard called the SK1, and it was one of the first sampling keyboards, and I'll actually sample my voice into it and create different instrument sounds out of that.
Oh, okay.
And I've become really kind of good at it. It's funny to talk about wanting to become known for playing a toy keyboard, but I'm really happy with that. I get a chance to play that on a lot of different records. You know, they were asking me what song that, you know, we wanted to, like, end with, since we really haven't played a lot of music.
Yeah, we haven't.
A lot of talking, though.
Yeah.
And I'm honored. I don't get a chance to talk like this. I thought that we would do one of my classical pieces that I did with Christine Wu for a Wayne Gilbert performance art piece that I took part in, called String. This will be on the second CD, and it will be song 7. It's just a little 2-minute piece, and actually, you can go ahead and cue it up, and I'll just talk over it for a second. Christine and I actually composed this as an arc from afternoon, early evening, midnight, you know, early in the morning. And they played it on KUHF, mm-hmm. and actually Dean Dalton over there, who's the big wig, you know, at KUHF, called me a composer. And I happened to be in the car when they played it, and it was probably one of the most thrilling moments of my life.
Oh, nice.
So anyway, this is me being a composer. Thanks a lot for having me on the show,
Robert. Yeah, we're going to close it out here so you guys enjoy the song. Thanks for coming out. Do you have a website you want to give out really quick?
DanWorkman.com, DanWorkman.
All right, thanks. You got to come back.
Sweet.